Welcome to the Promise Institute podcast, where we share critical conversations on human rights, a production of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA Law. Be sure to stay tuned after the episode to learn about ways to follow the Institute and to support our work.
Hello and welcome to this series of podcasts in which we'll be talking about the proposed new International Crime of Ecocide. The series is timed to coincide with the launch of our online symposium or collection of papers under the title An International Crime of Ecocide, New Perspectives, which examines ecocide from a whole range of different angles, such as how ecocide might contribute to environmental justice and reparations for climate harm, how it relates to rights of indigenous peoples and rights of nature, how to establish the mental element of the crime, and how it might best be brought into law. The symposium papers can be found on the website that we host along with the Stop Ecocide Foundation and the Human Rights Consortium at the University of London, ecocidelaw.com. I'm Kate McIntosh of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA School of Law. And today I am with authors Tamika Samuels-Jones from York University in Canada, Olivia Swart-Goldman from the Wildlife Justice Commission, and criminal, environmental and human rights lawyer Paolo Busse to look at three ecocide case studies: bauxite mining in Jamaica, deforestation in Brazil, and global wildlife crime. Before we get started, I should say that all of the papers in the symposium engage, although not necessarily exclusively, with the definition of ecocide proposed in June 2021 by the independent expert panel, which was convened by the Stop Ecocide Foundation. I was a member of that panel, which was chaired by Philippe Sands and Dior Falsau. And more information about the panel and its proposed definition can be found on ecocidelaw.com. So, Tamika, let me dive right in with you and your case study of bauxite mining in Jamaica. So why should ecocide be a major issue of concern for Jamaica right now?
Well, first of all, Kate, thank you so much for having me. I think one of the things that is paramount is how Jamaica is perceived. Jamaica is often seen as simply an island nation for tourism, and people don't really think about extractivism and more specifically bauxite mining as a cause for concern. However, bauxite mining is important to everyone, both those in the global north and the global south, because the byproduct of that is aluminium, which we find in everyone's home, through windows, in their kitchens, used to make aircrafts. Now, ecocide is a primary concern for Jamaica because of the environmental harm and devastation that is caused as a result of that. It has created, through that extractivism, conditions of dispossession of indigenous groups, destroyed farmlands, health concerns and issues ranging from cancer to premature death. So those are very important issues.
Thank you, Tamika. And I should say that listeners who want to know more about bauxite mining in Jamaica should read Tamika's paper, which goes into a lot more detail about the really horrific effects of that industry on the people and the environment in Jamaica. So, Tammy, maybe I could ask you, how does this mining match the definition of ecocide that was proposed by the independent expert panel?
Well, It's perfect. In terms of looking at bauxite mining, there are several key words that can be extracted from the definition created by Stop Ecocide Foundation's independent expert panel, which are very relevant in the Jamaican context. For example, if we look at the definition of the term wanton used by the independent panel, you will see that there has been precedence that has been set regarding the harms that are caused by bauxite mining through extractivism in countries outside of Jamaica, which would indicate that those companies, those multinational companies engaging in that practice, are aware of the harms that are being caused. If we look at the independent panel's definition of severe, in terms of the Jamaican context, those adverse changes, disruption or harms to the environment, those grave impacts on human life have been caused through the elimination of mineral-bearing soils, the physical reshaping of the landform, the impact on the processes that drive geobiological formation of new soils in Jamaica. We can also take the word widespread and unpack that in the Jamaican context to explore the fact that usually environmental harm, and as defined by the independent panel, extends beyond a limited geographic area. But in a small island nation such as Jamaica, even a relatively small geographic area in another country is the entire Jamaican, the island of Jamaica, which is only 10,000 square kilometers. So what bauxite mining has done is it has created circumstances where there has been displacement of indigenous communities from their land to more urban communities that do not contain their symbolic and cultural artifacts. There has been an additional burden to the island's skeletal healthcare system in other parts of the island as well, not to mention the impact of dispossessed farmers to the urban core.
Thanks, Tamika. And I think you raise a really interesting issue around the use of the word wanton, which the panel had defined as with reckless disregard for damage, which would be clearly excessive in relation to the social and economic benefits anticipated. And of course, this is really the crux of the conversation about extractive industries, who's benefiting and at whose cost, of course. And I mean, I'll come back to you again to talk a little more about what you think the Jamaican government's approach to this might be. But clearly there are particular communities, as you said, including indigenous communities and marginalized groups at whose expense this mining is going on. And the word wanton potentially provides a mechanism for that to be considered in assessing the crime. I want to bring Paolo in here. Paolo, your paper, which you co-authored with our mutual friend and collaborator Richard Rogers, looks at deforestation in the Amazon as ecocide. You've worked on environmental crime in the Amazon for many years. Could you tell us how you see deforestation fitting into the definition of ecocide, and also what difference an international crime of ecocide might make to the struggle in Brazil?
Well, first of all, the main difference in scale, I think, you know, we have a lot of minor situations of deforestation going on, as you know, in the Amazon and in the Cerrado biomes here in Brazil. And not all of them qualify to ecocide as proposed by the expert channel to the Rome Statute. Now, the good news is that we have a bill number 2933. Filed at the Brazilian Congress by a very interesting political party here in Brazil, very environmental, PSOL is called, proposing more or less the same wordings of the one proposed in the international sphere by the expert panel. So we have that. It's under consideration by the Brazilian Congress. So there is a chance that in the future we will have our own ecocide crime here in Brazil. Of course, not all situations of deforestation in the Amazon will amount to ecocide as defined in this bill. Only the more serious and encompassing situations that expand beyond geographic, sometimes even national borders, you know, which effects expand beyond geographic and national borders, and also affect a series of other constitutional rights, like the right to a life with dignity, food, health, indigenous rights, you know. Ecocide is a more all-encompassing and broader phenomenon. And that's why it has to be linked with a more serious penalty as well. Brazil is a very interesting country because we have a very complex and detailed set of environmental protection laws, perhaps the most complex in the world. But the problem is that the legal consequences doesn't discourage the main decision makers, you know, politicians, corporate executives, and financiers to fund or approve risky projects in the Amazon. The penalties, for instance, we have our own environmental crimes law. But the problem is that the penalties are very low to begin with. Also, the situations, I mean, the crimes cover a very minor situations like cutting trees, no matter how many trees, inside a conservation unit or inside an indigenous territory. The situations are very minor regarding what's going on in the Amazon. I mean, a major wave of deforestation going on, you know? So we need something bigger, something broader, more encompassing, which would be the ecocide.
Thank you, Paolo. I see actually some parallels, some nice parallels between the situation you're describing and the situation that I think Olivia is going to tell us about. So, Olivia, I had the pleasure of co-authoring our paper on wildlife crime with you and your colleagues, Grant Dawson and Gaspar van der Woude. Perhaps you could start by briefly explaining how wildlife crime could qualify as ecocide under the panel definition.
First of all, thank you, Kate, for having me and for the pleasure of co-authoring the paper together. Now, wildlife crime, while not defined by international treaty, is widely understood to include the poaching and trafficking of protected fauna and flora, thus endangered plants, sharks, rhinos, etc. And we're at risk of losing more than a million species in the coming decade, and wildlife crime is one of the main drivers. And what's interesting about wildlife crime is it's the fourth largest transnational organized crime, which create immense amount of profits for organized criminal groups who plunder our biodiversity for profit. So they're not doing it because they don't like the animals, they're doing it because it's a low risk, high reward crime type. And the World Bank has estimated that wildlife crime, so that's terrestrial fisheries crime and illegal logging, cost local communities about $1 to $2 trillion US dollars per year, just a massive amount of economic loss to these communities. And it's frequently linked with other kinds of organized crime, such as drugs, drug trafficking and human trafficking, and is really linked with corruption and money laundering. So it's this little sort of hotbed of criminal activity, and it drives our species to extinction. And it also has far-reaching impact on climate, public health, and international security and stability. So it has a big impact. So while this definition covers a variety of different acts, you know, from subsistence poaching in local communities to organized transnational crime, only the most severe and serious form of wildlife trafficking is relevant to the concept of ecocide. So we're talking about the most egregious forms. So indeed, there are some similarities to what Paolo was saying. And for serious wildlife crime to be prosecuted as ecocide, obviously we know it would have to be unlawful or wanton, severe, widespread, or long-term damage. So severity, we're talking about driving species to extinction, as well as the far-reaching consequences for humans and ecosystems. So I think, especially when we limit it to those types of wildlife crimes, then that would certainly meet the definition. In terms of widespread, you know, that is defined as extends beyond a limited geographic area, et cetera, and long-term as well, damage which is irreversible. So wildlife crime that leads to the extinction of species would surely meet this criteria. Of course, we'd need evidence to determine which particular action or group of actions in themselves cause substantial likelihood of extinction or threaten the survival of the species. But wildlife crime as a type definitely leads to the extinction of species and the reduction of their survival. So that would seem to meet those criteria. In terms of the unlawful criteria, that's also really easily satisfied in the case of wildlife crime. So CITES, which is the convention that governs the international trade in endangered species, has 184 state parties, and it deals with, you know, in great detail about how you can trade in these endangered species. And there are also national laws that cover this in addition to the CITES convention or implementing legislation. So most jurisdictions have laws related to wildlife crime. And even if they don't, then the wanton criteria would certainly be met because of the huge damage that's caused to local communities, as well as human health and climate that I already mentioned.
Between the three situations you describe, it strikes me that it's interesting in that, Olivia, you're talking about wildlife crimes. It's already criminal, as you said. It probably satisfies that requirement of unlawful in the international definition. And Paolo, much of what you were talking about in Brazil, as you said, is already unlawful. It's just that the penalties either are not enforced or are very low. Whereas Tammy, you're talking about a situation where this activity is a lawful activity, and we're looking instead at the alternative criterion of wanton, which is basically it should not be lawful because it's actually against some very fundamental principles such as sustainable development and so on. So I think it's a really interesting set of different situations, and I really recommend to the listeners to dive into the papers and read more about the different case studies. But Olivia, maybe I could just come back to you to ask how you think, given that much of this is already prohibited under different laws, how you think an international crime of ecocide could help prevent wildlife crime.
Well, that's what is so interesting, is the enormous impact that labeling wildlife crime serious wildlife crime as a form of ecocide could have. The current system for the preservation of our biodiversity and endangered species through prevention of wildlife crime is failing. So while we have some rules in place and some laws, they're not being applied to really go after those key individuals and to protect the most vulnerable species. So it's transnational crime. So it needs to be looked at coherently with a variety of different actors. And the problem is you really need to dedicate resources to it. And many governments aren't in a position, don't have the skill set to dedicate those resources to it. So they, to the extent they address wildlife crime, they tend to go for the low-level poachers and not always devoting the resources that are required to go after those most impactful offenders, those that are organizing the criminal activity and benefit the most from it. So by being able to qualify wildlife crime as ecocide, this could help in a number of ways. First, it could help fill the accountability gap, providing judicial fora for prosecution where relevant states are either unwilling or unable to deal with the crime. As I mentioned, wildlife crime is deeply embedded with corruption, and it's often there are challenges to bringing cases domestically. And also they don't necessarily have the ability to go after the high level criminals. So by labeling it as ecocide, you could help dedicate those resources that are needed to address this crime type, which is so devastating. It also can help go after those higher level offenders. Again, if you're thinking about who's really responsible for ecocide, they're going to be focusing naturally on the more high level offenders rather than the low level offenders. It also would encourage international cooperation to combat transnational crimes, in part through establishing common legal elements and avoiding disparate treatment of similar offenses in different jurisdictions. So right now, you know, the penalties vary widely. Some of the definitions vary. Sometimes you can only prosecute an individual if they're actually have their hands on the illegal wildlife product. Whereas, as we know, if we want to go up to the higher level offenders, they're further away. So some kind of harmonization of that would also be incredibly useful for addressing this crime. And finally, it can also have an expressive function, raise the profile of this crime and the international stigmatization of wildlife crime.
Thank you, that's really helpful. I want to come back to you, Tammy, actually, on this question of enforcement and ask you how you think or what you think some of the major challenges might be in enforcing ecocide law in Jamaica, and maybe also circling back, as I said, to that question about what the Jamaican government's role in all of this is and how that plays into enforcement issues.
Yes, well, that's actually a very important question because I think the Jamaican case highlights the extent to which governments and state institutions are often wedded to this dominant neoliberal extractivism concept, which is not often the best course of action for these small developing countries. So what the Jamaican government has opted to do is offer access to resources for extraction at the expense of environmental health. There are also local regulations that Jamaica has in place. We have around 12 different acts in place for environmental protection that are not being enforced due to a lack of political will. In many cases, some of these acts were transplanted from Britain before Jamaica was made independent, and the government has not seen it fit to either update those acts or deter and those who would practice environmental harmful activities by making those fines actually greater. So sadly, as is in the Jamaican case, the government has placed corporate and, you know, their own personal interests over the citizens of their jurisdiction, which is what makes making ecocide an international law applicable to Jamaica so important. Jamaica is often, the Jamaican government as a whole, is often not minded to put things in place unless there are conditions that are attached to structural adjustment policies as part of loans. And what that does is, although that brings investment to the country, it does not attach to it any real will or passion for ensuring that our environmental health or the health of the citizens is preserved in any way. saw the implementation of stringent environmental law with punitive and criminal sanctions is necessary for deterring and punishing ecocide. It's ideal in our case and in the case of other small countries that simply lack the resources to do it on its own. In cases where the government will always opt for the investment income from multinational corporations over the benefit of its citizens, there needs to be a more objective group governance mechanism for ensuring that citizens are protected.
You know, Tammy's raised the issue of, you know, this is a good thing for the people and the planet, but there are some major economic interests that are standing in the way of this moving forward. And I just wondered, you know, speaking from another Global South country, albeit a very different one, of course, Brazil and Jamaica, although they're quite close to each other, I suppose, in global terms, you know, how you see that argument playing out in Brazil. I mean, the economic interest, obviously the Amazon is an amazing economic resource as well. Paulo details in his paper the power of the ruralistas and of the structural forces that are destroying the Amazon. And I wonder how you see political will in Brazil resisting that at the moment. And obviously there's been a major change. And you've mentioned that the domestic bill has been introduced for ecocide. I wonder what you see the prospects for that. And I'm also wondering how you think Brazil might align around the call for an international crime of ecocide.
This is a very good question. You know, I'm very pessimistic regarding our political class, the politicians in Brazil, but I'm very optimistic with our civil society. The Brazilian civil society is growing very strong. It was responsible for ousting Bolsonaro and putting there Lula, who put the environmental agenda in the very center of his administration agenda, you know. At the same time, Lula is under pressure by a very hostile Congress, especially with regard to environmental projects. Also, Lula is still very enthusiastic on the oil and gas companies. He thinks that needs to be strengthened. So he's also now under pressure by the environmental movements in the Brazilian society, and even by the Minister of the Environment, Marina Silva, now. So the Brazilian government is a bit divided. The political party who filed the bill for the creation of ecocide in Brazil was not the Labour Party, Lula's party. It was a now opposition party, you know, and a minor party. It's called PSOL. Sometimes they align the Labour Party with PSOL because they are both left-wing parties. But sometimes, especially with regard to environmental initiatives like the creation of ecocide, they are not aligned. So Brazilian politics is very complex. I am not very optimistic that during this administration, we will be able to get it approved in the Brazilian Congress. Not to mention to have the Brazilian support to the international initiative of including ecocide in the Rome Statute. I don't see it coming, at least coming from Lula, the president. But I totally see it coming from Marina Silva, the Minister of the Environment, which is a very strong minister, and this is a good news. So it's kind of, you know, we are divided in this. But then we have a very strong civil society that is basically becoming more and more sensitive to environmental agendas, and especially to the idea that we have a problem and that we need a law like an ecocide, a stronger law to fight the problem. You know, this is all, it makes me kind of optimistic in all this.
Fantastic. Thanks for that great explanation of a very complex situation. I guess all national situations are pretty complex when you dig into them. I want to just come back to Olivia and Tammy, if they'd like to give us some closing remarks. Tammy, please, final thoughts.
Absolutely. I wanted to close by saying I don't think that the enactment of ecocide as international law is far-fetched. In fact, it's necessary. International law already sanctions acts that cause widespread and severe harm to the environment during wartime. And it seems almost absurd that the same policy is not applied during peacetime. It's important to remember that lives are dependent on the implementation of this legislation. So that's always important to consider, even when thinking about the pros and cons and the challenges of its implementation.
Oh, thank you for reminding us about that. Olivia, some final words from you.
Just to say that it's absolutely necessary to ensure that there is accountability for the destruction of our environment. And specifically, I would argue for the driving of our species to extinction for profit. There's no way back from that. And we need to make sure that those individuals that are responsible for that at the highest level are arrested and successfully prosecuted, and that the sentences are severe. And ecocide would be a great way to make sure that happens.
Well, thank you all very much for bringing the reality of the situation and the relevance of ecocide law to life today. And as I said again, I really encourage everyone to read the papers which go into all of these points in more detail. So as a reminder, this podcast is one in a series of conversations around different aspects of the proposed new international crime of ecocide. And the series is timed to coincide with the launch of our online symposium on the same topic, which you can find on ecocidelaw.com. Each of our interviewees on the podcast has authored one of the 15 short papers on the site, from how ecocide applies to bauxite mining in Jamaica or international wildlife crime, as we've heard today, to how it might best be brought into law, contribute to environmental justice, or interact with the rights of nature. The site also hosts a regularly updated annotated bibliography, which lists and summarizes publications on ecocide, as well as information on the proposed definition and legal developments around the world. And we will have to add ecocide law in Brazil very soon, I hope, Paolo. So if listeners want to know more, please visit ecocidelaw.com.
Look for the Promise Institute on social media. You can find us under the handle @PromiseInst UCLA. And please consider supporting our work by making a donation. Visit law.ucla.edu/supportpromise to contribute at any level and help make conversations like these possible. Last thing, make sure you're subscribed to the show to be sure to catch future episodes. Until next time, take care.